From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, a powerful earthquake and a new president in Chile. Iraqis get ready for parliamentary elections and the hunt for homemade bombs on an Afghan battlefield. Chile is dealing with one of the most powerful earthquakes ever recorded, and it's also on the verge of a political transition. Liberal President Michelle Bachelet's term expires next week. She'll be replaced by one of the richest men in the country, conservative Sebastián Piñera. Bachelet has been strongly criticized in Chile for her response to the quake, and some say the impending transition has complicated the government's handling of the disaster. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports from the capital, Santiago.
In an hour-long emotional radio appearance broadcast up and down Chile, President Michelle Bachelet defended her response to Saturday's earthquake.
Piense usted que todos los sistemas de comunicaciones se cayeron.
President Bachelet said that in the hours immediately after the 8.8 earthquake, all the communication systems in the country collapsed. She wasn't able to find out if there was a tsunami. She couldn't even reach some of her key staff to arrange a helicopter in order to tour the damaged areas. In the 1970s, Bachelet was tortured by the military under the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. This week, she was hesitant to send in the army to restore order in the worst-hit parts of Chile, and she's been strongly criticized for this. Chile is one of the most prosperous nations in Latin America. In the capital, glimmering skyscrapers jut up in front of the Andes. It has billions of dollars in fiscal reserves, and there's a sense of pride here that the country knows how to handle earthquakes. But Bachelet denied that she ever turned down offers of international aid.
Lo que yo señalé es que necesitábamos.
What I said was we have to have an exact analysis of what it is we need so that we can ask for it, Bachelet said. Bachelet said rumors and misinformation are creating a national psychosis. In addition to responding to criticism, Chile's first female president also stressed that the recovery is going to take time. She called for patience.
Yo quisiera decirle a la gente.
Bachelet's voice cracked with emotion as she told her people to have confidence that her government is doing everything possible to reach areas still cut off by the quake and tsunami. But the criticism continues.
No doubt that Michelle Bachelet's legacy has been damaged seriously by the earthquake. That's no doubt.
Raúl Soar is a political analyst at Chile Vision, one of the largest TV networks in the country. It also happens to be owned by incoming President Sebastián Piñera.
She's been most unlucky. It all seemed to be glory in the final days of her government, but now she has stumbled badly.
Sources the failure of Chile's tsunami warning system, the looting in quake-ravaged areas, and the slow pace of aid deliveries has made many Chileans feel that the government abandoned them during this crisis. He says the natural disaster has exposed the deep divide between rich and poor in Chile.
What earthquakes do, they make countries naked, no? And you can see through all the weaknesses. And here for decades, we have been talking about exclusion, about the people who are marginated. Well, all those marginals have come out into the streets. Some of them have looted supermarkets.
Especially in the capital, modern buildings withstood the quake unscathed, yet adobe and brick houses in poorer neighborhoods were severely damaged. Soar adds that the earthquake also puts incoming President Piñera in a difficult spot. Piñera has been careful not to step on Bachelet's toes during the crisis, and Bachelet says her administration is working closely with his transition team. But Piñera has made it clear that he would have sent the army in immediately. At an event yesterday with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Piñera declared maintaining public order as the government's first priority during a crisis, followed by the distribution of food and water. Piñera added, however, that this is not a time to assign blame, but rather for all Chileans to work together to solve the country's huge current problems. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Santiago.
Chile's earthquake, one of history's most potent, triggered tsunamis. It also touched off a man-made chaos, widespread looting. The assault on stores astonished Chileans, who thought their fast-developing country was immune to that kind of mayhem. That's prompting a lot of new soul-searching for some in the South American country. NPR's Juan Forero reports from the battered city of Concepcion.
A Chilean television crew captures looters targeting a neighborhood and the quick counterattack by a group of vigilantes. Such images have been jarring in a tranquil, prosperous country considered Latin America's most politically and socially stable. Crime is low here, poverty levels have fallen dramatically, and economists say Chile will soon go from third world to first world status, the only country to do so in the region. But the looting exposed social fissures. Some Chileans, like Piero Mochiati, director of Radio Biobío here in the earthquake zone, say it's made people question just how much progress Chile has really made. He says there's deep-seated resentments felt by those on the margins of society, people who felt they haven't shared in Chile's good times. And Mochiati says the looting shows that the income inequality in Chile is perhaps greater than previously thought. The looters, at first, targeted supermarkets here in Concepcion and surrounding towns. Then they turned to clothing boutiques and electronics stores, in a frenzy burning some of them to the ground. The few policemen were powerless to stop them. The military was not called to restore order for a full day after the raids began. Still, even days later, looters combed through gutted stores and overturned shipping containers on Concepcion's destroyed port. 19-year-old Pablo Castro says it's necessary to find food and milk. Then he explains how the general chaos led him and others to turn their attention to malls and other stores. Just how serious the looting remains became apparent as a new tremor shook the earth and authorities issued a tsunami warning. I was talking to Castro on the docks as soldiers started shouting, "Hurry, hurry!" Looters immediately began emerging from overturned shipping containers and portside offices, dozens of them. In downtown Concepcion, calm has returned. Residents gingerly step on broken glass to see how their neighborhood supermarket was sacked of practically everything. The only sign of life, a heavily armed soldier standing guard outside. Patricia Solar, a housewife, says she understands why it happened. She says stores were closed after the quake and that one day of that was fine. But two? People were desperate, she explains, and couldn't be stopped. On the corner, Hugo Carrasco hawks newspapers. Feet away is his newsstand, now destroyed, just like the big clothing store in front, which was gutted by fire after being emptied by looters. He says he lost everything, not to the quake, but to the looters. He says he'd never seen anything like it, a giant mob of people that had lost all reason. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Concepcion, Chile.
Coming up, Iraq prepares for parliamentary elections and finding the bombs in Marja.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. Iraq is blanketed with campaign posters as it prepares for nationwide elections on Sunday. Most of the campaign slogans clamor for change. Some even have it written in English as well as Arabic. Nonetheless, many of the faces on the posters haven't changed at all from the election 4 years ago, although the alliances have shifted, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports from Baghdad.
Major projects in Iraq, as in the rest of the world, have a way of getting completed just before election time. Iraqi police directed traffic across a new highway overpass in North Baghdad that links two notoriously gridlocked neighborhoods. Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's incumbent prime minister, presided over the celebration.
This is
This is only a sample, Maliki said, of the reconstruction that has been achieved in Iraq because of improved security. The message is none too subtle, and it has hollowed a bit after several recent bombings left hundreds dead and demolished government buildings. Despite his popularity and his liberal use of the bully pulpit, Maliki is far from a shoo-in for re-election. Iraq's politics are often seen in three pieces: the Shiite majority in the south, the Kurds in the north, and a large wedge of Sunni Arabs in the middle. But the political alliances have become much more complicated.
The negotiation for these alliances is already going on and has been going on for some time.
Rend Rahim is a candidate with a secular nationalist party. She names six major electoral slates that she says have already been haggling over how to form a ruling alliance. Rahim says these six lists know they'll get a good number of votes, but no single slate will win the simple majority needed to form a government.
You need a majority of 50% plus one. I don't think any political list or political group that's running for election is going to get anywhere near 51%.
Of the six players, Rahim herself is on the slate of Ayad Alawi, a secular Shiite who has attracted nationalists from both Shiite and Sunni Arab communities. Alawi was briefly prime minister appointed by the Americans in 2004. Two other politicians have tried to claim a non-sectarian nationalist label, sitting Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the current Interior Minister Jawad al-Balani. Both are Shiite, but have reached out to popular Sunnis. The other major lists are a bit more homogeneous. Shiite religious parties have banded together with a deal reputed to have been made in Iran, including the anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. An almost purely Sunni Arab coalition includes the Speaker of Parliament, Ayad al-Samarai. Samarai is frank that he believes Iraqis will still vote more according to sect than any political program a candidate is offering.
The people will vote according to loyalty rather than to programs. And when we reach to a point that the people will vote for programs, then we can see there is no sectarian behavior affecting the election.
The last major factor is the Kurds, who actually have some bitter internal divisions, but with regards to the parliament in Baghdad, Kurds are expected to maximize their pull and vote as a bloc. Roche Shaways is a senior Kurdish politician and currently the deputy prime minister. He says the Kurds feel confident that no coalition can form a government without them.
We are all waiting the election, and then we will see what the negotiation then bring, depending on the results of the election.
Without big surprises, it will take at least three of the six major players to band together in order to form a government, along with a few smaller independents. Almost no combinations are out of the question. Prime Minister Maliki is expected by many to get the most votes, but that doesn't guarantee he'll form the winning coalition. Maliki himself became prime minister as a weak compromise candidate, and then slowly grew into a powerful figure. Rend Rahim says that may happen again.
A prime minister emerging from a coalition of three or more political groups in parliament. These groups will want the prime minister to be weak. They may feel that it is in their interest not to have another Maliki.
But she adds that Maliki may have shown that there's no such thing as a weak Iraqi prime minister. Quil Lawrence, NPR News, Baghdad.
In southern Afghanistan, U.S. Marines and their Afghan counterparts are tightening their hold on the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. Each day, troops are uncovering weapons caches left behind by Taliban fighters who ran away or are hiding among the local population. But even with the militants' departure, one major threat remains for the troops and for local civilians: homemade bombs called IEDs. Many hundreds of them were planted across the 70 square miles of the Marja district in the months leading up to the offensive. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson recently embedded in Marja with India Company of the 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines, which spent most of its waking hours dealing with IEDs.
The Marines detonate 400 pounds in IEDs they uncover on the bridge into northwestern Marja. The so-called daisy chain of bombs could have killed and maimed a lot of troops if they'd driven across them. But in this controlled explosion, the only casualties are a dozen doors and abandoned stores that are blown off their hinges. Captain Bill Hefti commands India Company, which discovered the bombs and captured the militant holding the detonator.
I wasn't shocked at their IEDs, but I was a little shocked they were completely set up for us to come north to south, straight up the middle. I thought they would have thought I was a little smarter than that.
Outsmarting the Taliban in hopes of avoiding these deadly bombs is a full-time job for Hefti and his team. So is the hunt to find all of the IEDs and areas where the Marines and Afghan soldiers are forced to tread, says First Lieutenant Justin Gray, who is 27 and from Atlanta.
We can see the guys that are shooting at us, but we can't see this stuff in the ground. You know, we have dogs and we have metal detectors, both great assets, but sometimes it's just luck, you know. But yeah, the IEDs are definitely the greater threat. It's harder to counter those than it is to counter a small arms fire.
In the first 3 days of the offensive, Gray's men uncovered nearly 20 IEDs in a tiny village they captured from the Taliban, but there were a few they missed.
Hey, listen up! Everybody's got to push back that way.
One Marine warns the others to get back. An explosives team just found two IEDs right outside the gas station in which they spent the night. Gunnery Sergeant E.J. Pate from Mullins, South Carolina, helps blow up the IEDs.
They're probably going to find quite a few more in this area.
And what is this exactly? Like, how many pounds is this?
So about 60 pounds. It's probably an ammonium nitrate aluminum powder mixture, which is what they've been using so far. And it provides blasting cap of some sort and a pressure plate with a power source.
Later that morning, Staff Sergeant David Sutherland of Carbondale, Illinois, takes another group of explosives experts and combat engineers to clear a road between India and Kilo companies so they can start moving troops and supplies.
Do you worry when you do this?
There's always some bit of worry, man, but I feel that we're trained well enough to prepare for it. So it is what it is. It's here to save lives and help people out.
Sutherland and two other explosives experts slowly wave handheld metal detectors over the dirt road and across nooks and crannies in nearby mud walls. When they get a solid reading, the combat engineers with them spring into action. They use their knives to dig into the dirt in search of a pressure plate or wire. Sometimes they gently kick at a suspected spot with their boot. Most of the time, the digging and kicking reveal it's a false alarm. Juice containers, bullet casings, even single servings of instant coffee in aluminum wrappers set off the detectors. But the good news, Sutherland says, is their thorough search means they can clear this patch of road. He decides to spot check an area nearby that was briefly swept by another patrol.
I like to double check it because people have missed them in the past. Not good.
It turns out to be the right call.
Further back.
Sutherland has found an IED. To get rid of it, he blows it up. The staff sergeant says what tipped him off to the IED were two larger stones he spotted nearby, one on top of the other. The stones were a warning from the Taliban to local Marja residents not to tread there. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.